Hi, I'm Tommy, and I'm the host of Tea and Waffles, a guide to 2021, powered by Transmission Roundhouse. In this six-part series, I'm sitting down with amazing guests and opening the lid on issues faced by young people, hopefully providing some guidance to propel you through this messy COVID period, starting your 2021 the right way. Welcome to episode 5. This guide is a little different from the other ones because, if I'm honest, I don't think I have the answer to this one. For those who don't already know, the host who does the absolute most is from London, the Big Smoke, a city with so much heritage and history. The land where generations of people have raised families and other people have travelled thousands of miles to start their own. The same city where you can get yourself a pint of Strongbow and Wetherspoons, cross the road and order a curry goat and rice and peas from the yard shop, then wander into the corner shop next door to grab a bag of plantain chips. Honestly, it's amazing. The city has got so much to offer, but it's the most culturally confusing part of the country. 2 years ago, I finally attended Notting Hill Carnival, the annual Caribbean festival flowing through the most affluent borough of London, Kensington and Chelsea. The day was a vibe. Loud music thumped, majestic headdresses and costumes from the parade processions were on show, and I had enough Magnum and rum punch in the system to party for at least 3 more days. As the event started to reach its finale, I waded through the crowd to avoid the rush and find the train home. But here I met my biggest surprise of the day. It wasn't a gladiatorial bloodbath the British media loved to make the festival out to be, but the egress of mostly white attendees entering the grand maisonettes the borough is famous for, and across the road, many people of colour drifting into the distinctive council tower blocks, which confused me as I thought things would be different in the richest part of town. Since a young age, I knew race played a major factor in my day-to-day life. As growing up, I would read newspapers or turn on the TV and struggle to see faces like mine on there, unless they were attached to negative headlines. Walking around my local area and smiling warmly at people in an attempt to reassure those tightly gripping their belongings or crossing the road from me. Or not really understanding why my mum would always tell me because of my skin, I had to work 10 times harder than everyone else. I sometimes reminisce on all the things I learned at school, like the stunning works of Shakespeare, tales of British kings, and the amazing white mathematicians and scientists who lay the foundations of all we see today. But at the same time, I wonder why they failed to also mention the award-winning poetry of Benjamin Zephaniah, the stories of Mansa Musa, the richest king in history, spreading religion, wealth, and academia across Africa and Arabia, and the many mathematicians and scientists who made and shared their ingenious discoveries with European travellers and continue to invent and make scientific breakthroughs even in periods where it was unlawful for them to do so. During this time, I don't think many of us realise this is also where we unconsciously learned not to like ourselves. I still remember school days where we would laugh and take the mick out of each other for the shades of our skin, texture of our hair, facial features, the parts of Africa and the Caribbean that we came from, and even the accents that we picked up from our parents, or if you spoke too white, or whatever that means. It's funny how when you're younger, you can simultaneously be so attentive to everything cool and trending in the world, but yet be so out of touch with yourself and your identity. It brings me so much joy to see the large majority of people I've grown up with actively try to unlearn and celebrate all those things we used to tease each other about, and the inspiring things British people of colour are accomplishing to dispel the conspiracy theories about the true pandemic that is racism. I think race is always going to be a difficult and uncomfortable one to talk about, at least within my lifetime. But if you saw the title and clicked, congratulations. You've taken the first big step in reaching a solution, and probably the most important, you've prepared yourself to listen. The next section you're about to hear is a conversation between myself and Habiba, a freelance writer featuring in popular publications such as The Independent, Galem, Restless Network, and more. In this episode, we talk about race and our feelings on the current race conversation within the UK. I hope this episode can be a start point for your honest conversations with friends, family, and colleagues about your feelings on race.
For me personally, when it comes to race, I feel like we need to talk about it as much as possible, really and truly. Because we forget the amount of racism that's been prevalent in this country for decades now. In the 1970s and 1980s, we had loads of riots purely because of racism. Like, look at Mark Duggan as well, only a couple of years ago. Like, racism is still very prevalent, like, in society. We know that black people get stopped and searched 9 times more than white people. So is 100% something we still need to talk about. And if we don't talk about it, it's something that will just slip through the cracks and people will get comfortable. It's not something we need to see.
Good morning, good evening, salutations, people. You're tuning in not for a regular episode of the Team Office podcast, but a series powered by Roundhouse London, exploring issues faced by young people in the COVID period, and hopefully creating a definitive guide to help you through your 2021. Today, I have a very, very special guest who goes by the name of Habiba Katsa. I got it right? So I'm joined with Habiba Katsa. She is a journalist and a writer featuring for publications such as Galem, The Independent, Restless Network, and also been a speaker on LBC. But I'm going to hand over to Habiba and she can give you a personal introduction of herself and what she's all about.
Hi guys, so yeah, my name is Habiba and I'm a freelance writer and a part-time staff writer for Restless Network, which is a publication for non-binary women and women. And yeah, outside of that, I'm a freelance journalist and I usually write about race, gender and mental health. And I've written for publications such as like Huffington Post and Independent, Galdem. And yeah, I've been a writer for three going on 4 years now. So yeah.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for coming on, by the way.
Thank you for having me.
Actually, first, before we even go in, I actually kind of wanted to know, what made you want to go into writing and journalism?
Well, when I was younger, I actually wanted to be an actress, but then my mum said, she was like, Habiba, you ask too many questions, so you're either going to be a police officer or a journalist. Yeah. So she made me take a photojournalism course when I was 15, and I really enjoyed it, but I didn't really go back to that after until I was like 17. I did communications at sixth form, and then I did international media and communications in uni, and I realized that our stories weren't really being represented properly in the media, and I wanted to help change the representation of black people in the media. So I started writing for my uni publication, Impact Magazine, when I was like in second year. And then after uni, I interned at like Dirt Days, Sunday Times, Elle and stuff like that. And then I just started freelancing. So yeah.
Oh, that's great. And that was all within a 4 year period?
Yeah. So we finally got there, but yeah.
Wow. That's amazing that you managed to squeeze in so much in such a short period of time.
It feels like it's not a lot, but I feel like now everything's coming into place. It's been a journey, but I'm here now.
Okay, great. So as you can hear, Habiba has done quite a lot on a few different areas, and the race element is predominantly the reason why I wanted to get you on, because I feel like you could really give a really good insight into race relations within the UK, and also just having a real talk about what we can actually practically do to improve those relations on a day-to-day level, because I feel like a lot of people, they sort of just hear a lot about race, but they don't know what personally they can do to really impact or do anything or make a change. They kind of feel a little bit helpless. Mm-hmm. So I kind of wanted to really just delve into that and just kind of talk about what we can do on personal levels to help the real greater cause and the greater issue. Mm-hmm. And also just really understand what's really going on in the UK from a young person's perspective.
So
that is the topic of discussion for today. But before that, I like to have a nice little icebreaker question to ease the guest in. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of trainers. I'm a big sneakerhead. So what I like to do is that I like to have a crepe check before. But it's in lockdown, so I know it could be a little bit difficult. So I've got two options for you, Habiba. Mm-hmm. Either you can be honest and tell us what's on your feet, or you could tell us, if you had any choice of any pair of shoes, what would you have on?
Well, okay, currently I have socks, so that's what I have at the moment. In terms of trainers, I like trainers, but I don't know the names of them.
Okay, so, I can try and help you out.
Literally, I don't know any. Like, I have Nike Air Monarchs, I think. That's what I wear all the time.
Okay.
Or I'm like a New Balance girl.
Oh yeah, New Balances, yeah, quality.
I wore during uni. I forgot which ones I have. I have these grey Nike trainers. They're a bit chunky, but I don't know what they're called. I think 95s.
95s. Yeah.
I think
quite chunky soles.
Yeah. Other than that, I really don't know. Like, I'm really more of a heel boot babe.
Oh, okay. Okay.
If I could wear any sort of shoes, it would be now, like, chunky, what is it? Not high waist. Chunky high knee boots.
Oh, what? The ones that go all the way up to your knees? The knee high boots. Yeah. Okay. They're definitely in style. Yeah, definitely in style.
That's what I've been wearing. I literally bought them just before. There's been so many lockdowns, so I don't know which one this was, but I bought them.
It's like lockdown part five now.
Literally, I bought them just before, I think, the last lockdown. I was so close to returning them because I was like, I'm never going to leave my house again, but I just kept them. So, yeah.
Basically, I love talking about race. I truly enjoy it. I think it's quite an invigorating topic to discuss, especially with people who come from different backgrounds, different races, or even people who come from my own race but have had a different upbringing and therefore see racism and just race as a whole through a different lens. It can also be quite frustrating when you're talking to people who are quite close-minded, have their preconceived notions and come to the discussions with their predispositions, you know. But at the same time, on the whole, it is quite an important topic to discuss frequently, because I feel like race is a social construct and it is constantly changing the way people adapt and the way people kind of talk about the topic is constantly changing. So it is, on the whole, a good discussion topic. I like talking about it.
Now I kind of want to get into really the meat and bones of the conversation. I feel like the lockdown period lockdown and coronavirus has kind of been synonymous with race. I don't think you've been able to escape one without the other.
Yeah.
Primarily the George Floyd incident, which happened in America, mm-hmm. In which an unarmed black man was killed by police officers. Mm-hmm. And I think that was really a catalyst for race conversations across the globe.
Yeah.
What I wanted to talk about was how it has affected us in the UK, because I think quite a lot of the time it's kind of considered a thing which is happening overseas.
Yeah.
And it's not really our issue.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because while here in the UK it's very, very subtle.
Yeah.
Whereas in the US and other places like Brazil, it's very, very overt.
Yeah, exactly.
It's hard to really miss it. Mm-hmm. So what I want to ask to you really is that Why do you think that race is such an important conversation to have?
I feel like it's an important conversation to have because if you don't have the conversation, then there's no action. Like, for example, the way that you said, in comparison to like the UK to the US in terms of racism, I think the reason why it is a bit, it's probably a bit more subtle here is because we don't really speak about racism at all. So in America, from what we've seen, obviously they have more conversations about race because it's more overt. Whereas here, because we stray away from the topic and we think it's not that bad, white people and non-black people in general don't think it's an issue because we don't speak about it. So I think the more conversations we have, people can be educated on why it is an issue, and then action should hopefully follow from that. Yeah.
Would you say that overt or covert racism is worse or not as bad as the other? Or do you think there's not really a difference?
I feel like both of them come with different things. I think I feel like it's, how can I phrase this? The only reason why I'd say that overt is worse is because it leads to death. But I feel like covert probably leads to like a slower death, even if it's not physical, it's mental, because like here, microaggressions can drive you crazy in as much as it, like, people think that it's not that serious. Like microaggressions at work, like it can really have an effect on your mental health. So I don't want to say that, you know, we have it better here, but I will just say that I think it's just a bit different.
Do you think that that race is really a conversation that we're actively having, or is it, do you think that it's something on the sidelines, that it's a conversation that only a few people are really actually having productive conversations about?
I feel like this year has influenced people to have conversations, but I don't know if they're actually having productive conversations. As you said, this is the first time like in my life that I've seen people speak about racism this way on a global scale. In this country, we've seen incidents like with Stephen Lawrence and Mark Duggan where they speak about racism, but this year was like intense. Like it was like from June to October that people speak about racism all the time. But I don't know if conversations are productive because they can often be quite performative, especially online. So the conversations have been happening more, but I don't know in terms of action what's really followed from these conversations.
Yeah. I really do hear you with the point about being performative.
Yeah.
I think that has been happening a lot where a lot of brands at times were really like they were forced to put out statements as opposed to it looked like they were forced to put out statements due to social pressure than them actually wanting to actually put out statements themselves or actually take action.
Because
I think a few brands, a few companies really did take action in terms of having a look at what they could do within their own internal structure.
Yeah.
Primarily being, I think there was a editor in Vogue.
Was it Edward Edifel?
Yes. I do believe it was him.
Yeah.
Him, for example, was an example of a brand having a look at their structure and having a look at how they could actually change the way in which that their structure looks like so they can cater to certain groups and have a real holistic approach in how they show their brand to the world. Like if you're having different voices from different backgrounds, you can really actually have productive change.
Exactly.
And if you are trying to make real statements of intent and of change, if you have people within your structure and not having to get external people like influencers to come and speak on your behalf, then you can make some real actual changes as opposed to just performative ones, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah. I think this is the issue that happened when there's not enough black people that work in these organizations, because it was clear to see that because of the lack of diversity that they had, people were just putting out statements and people putting out things, and it was very rushed rather than actually taking the time out to understand. So that's what I feel like that whole time was just a bit messy.
Yeah, 100%. I agree with you. I think that it is a diversity issue. And I think it's kind of ingrained, because when you look universally across at a lot of companies and a lot of brands, the structure looks exactly the same. It doesn't have a lot of diversity. It may have a few splashes of people of color. It may have a few splashes of gender diversity, but at the top, it's very clear. It's white and male.
Exactly.
And I think that is something which really needs to be tackled, because if you're really wanting to have equality and real dialogue and real intent into how you approach diversity and including people, then you need to change what your structure looks like. Otherwise, your practice is always going to stay the same.
Yeah, I agree.
I think in general, talking about race can be uncomfortable for a lot of people. For me personally, I actually quite enjoy it. Not because I enjoy exploring how the dynamics of race have, you know, disenfranchised Black people or anything like that. But sometimes it's kind of interesting to have those uncomfortable discussions with people, because that's how you usually get people to learn more, who don't realise what's going on in terms of race, or sort of to explore how and why we can sort of solve issues that we currently have. So I mean, talking about it just usually makes me quite like passionate, really. It just gets me fired up.
I wanted to talk about a point which you made actually about microaggressions. I actually want to ask, have you ever been faced with microaggressions while you've been at work?
Yeah, but they're really minute. Like, it's just more so like I can only remember once. Basically, I was having like chin-chin, and then...
Oh, yeah. What, you're Nigerian?
I'm actually not Nigerian. I'm Congolese, but yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, in Asda, they sell like coconut. It sounds weird, but it's delicious.
No,
it's like,
I've had it.
It's so good. It's like... Oh, so good. So, yeah, so I was eating at my desk, and then... one of my managers was like, what is that? It looks like dog food. And I was like, it's chin chin. And then she had it. She was like, oh my gosh, this actually tastes really nice. And I was just like, yeah. But other than that, I haven't really experienced any sort of microaggressions, but that's the one that I just remember the most. I think it's more so just like not feeling like I fit in at work sometimes and being the only Black person there. But yeah.
So when you was at work, and you felt, obviously not you felt, you were the only Black person there at work.
Yeah.
How did you deal with that on a day-to-day in terms of mentally sort of preparing yourself to go to work? Did it take a toll on you? Did it affect your work in any shape or form?
I think it's more so just like knowing that you can't slip up, knowing that you can't be angry. Like, I felt like I feel like when I'm with white people, I can never ever be angry. I must always be calm, which is very annoying. But yeah, relatively, I've had like quite good experiences, but I think it's just like an underlying feeling of just thinking that these people don't think that I'm good enough.
What do you think is the base for that? Like, did you ever feel like the base for that was due to the fact that you're a woman of color, or do you think it's down to you as a person? Because sometimes you can just honestly feel like you have certain pressures for yourself that you've created for yourself, but also do you think that might be that on the fact that you are a woman?
Well, I've mainly only worked around women anyways. So I think it was more so just the way that I felt in a certain publication. I just felt like they were always trying to check if I did something right and like accusing me of doing things wrong all the time. So yeah, that's why I felt like they felt that I wasn't good enough. So yeah.
Talking about race can be like a hard thing to talk about. I mean, we can't shy from the fact that being treated differently or unfairly because of race, skin color, ethnicity, you know, it can have a negative impact in the young generations of today. And we know racism can happen anywhere. It can happen at school, work, at home, can happen online, outside, even within families or and relationships. So it is something that needs to be talked about and addressed, and we need to be comfortable in talking about race within our communities, within not just our community but within other communities as well. I think within the UK, talking about race or racism or whatever it is, it's more of a covert kind of conversation. Like, I have no feeling towards it. Talking about it is what it is. It's the facts. So there is no emotion in talking about race because it's either this or that. So yeah.
Just having a talk about microaggressions. How do you think people can really effectively check their own biases? Because I think we've really had a realization about people having unconscious bias.
Mm.
And that conversation has really opened up this year. That a lot of people haven't realized that they do certain things around people and not really realize why that they're doing those things.
Yeah.
A prime example of that is when people having interactions with the police, like during coronavirus. Mm-hmm. There was triple the amount of black people being arrested or being fined by police officers when they were out compared to their white counterparts. So essentially my question is that how can people think about their actions and take action on how they're thinking about a certain group of people or some certain demographic to really check their inherent biases?
I think just thinking about why you feel a certain way about certain groups and why you think a certain way about a certain group but don't think that way about another group of people, and just analysing where that also comes from. Mm-hmm. And I think also just checking the emotion that you feel when you're with that certain group, when you're around a group of black men, why is it that you feel scared or you're... Yeah, why do you feel scared and you don't feel scared when you're grouped with white men? So I think things like that, or even like this year, obviously we've seen a rise in hate crime towards South Asian people. Why do you feel like they're more likely to get the virus, to spread the virus than white people? So I think just analysing where your ideologies come from, I think, and just being honest with yourself, to be honest, because I think a lot of people just want to lie and say that they don't have problematic views. Everyone does. I think it's about analysing where these views come from and why you think that way.
So even on that point of really having an internal conversation, mm-hmm. Do you think that's the reason why sometimes it's difficult to talk about race?
Mm. Yeah, I think so, because people don't want to have the conversation with themselves and they don't think about it. So I think that people don't, especially white people, they don't think about race in the same way that people of color do. So it's hard for them to have the conversation because you're having a conversation about something you don't think about on an everyday basis.
Do you think for yourself that having a conversation sometimes with other people, because you said that that sometimes white people do have an issue talking about race because they don't think about race on a day-to-day basis,
mm-hmm.
like when they step outside of the house, you don't think, is my hair presentable?
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to think if I am behaving in a certain way, there's not going to be any adage.
Mm.
Like if I'm aggressive, I'm starting to have to think, is he going to be looking at me in a certain type of way? Is he going to think that I'm a gangbanger? Is he gonna, like, there's adages, whereas they don't have to think about that.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that because they don't have to think about race in that type of way, that's why the conversation is difficult to have, and when someone does bring up those sorts of points, that their back is against the wall?
Yeah, I think that's definitely it, because like white people have white guilt and white frigidity, so they automatically assume that they're not racist. And they don't think about it. So it's hard to have the conversations with people who don't think about it and also don't understand race. Because even if you're a person of color, that doesn't mean that you understand the concept of race. You can understand racism because you've experienced it, but like the study of race is like a really, it's really like it's 400 years plus deep. But yeah, I do think that contributes to why it is hard speaking to white people about race.
Mm. So you actually spoke about white fragility, mm-hmm. and white guilt. Could you explain what that is just for anyone who's listening?
So white fragility is essentially the idea that when white people speak about race or when people around white people speak about race, they get really uncomfortable and they feel fragile. It's almost like they feel somewhat attacked. And that's an emotion that they feel when someone's discussing racism. And white guilt is the feeling of essentially feeling guilt that you've done something personally to people of color. So that's the your first response when people start speaking to racism, they just get really apologetic. So yeah.
Oh, okay, perfect. Thank you. That was a perfect definition. Actually, I wanted to ask you, how do you feel about talking about race with people?
I don't speak to non-black people about race most of the time, if I'm being honest. Like, after Renny Edo published that book, I said, yeah. Like, even when I went to uni, I went to a white predominant uni, university. I didn't speak to them about racism because I just wanted to protect my peace. Like, when it comes to racism, I get very heated. I've calmed down now. But I get really heated, so I didn't do it. Like, I'm only willing to have the conversations with people that are willing to unlearn and are not defensive. Like, even on the internet, after I've written articles, people sometimes in my DMs, I just ignore them because I don't have time for that. Like, because if it's not racism, then it's misogynoir, and I can't be bothered. So I only speak to black people about it, really, or Asian people, and even then it's long. So yeah, I don't really speak to people who are non-black about racism.
This is a perfect point. I actually kind of wanted to really delve into that, the conversation about race, mm-hmm. Because this kind of ties back into what I was talking about, the race conversation being difficult to have.
Mm.
Because I've kind of found personally that white people are very, very apprehensive to have that conversation,
mm-hmm.
because they don't want to be accused of anything.
Mm-hmm.
But then also black people, not black people, but people of color, because mm-hmm. racism affects a huge demographic of people, but they also don't want to continue having the conversation because people of color go through it every single day, live it every single day. So having the conversation is like you doing twice the work. Like I go through it and now I have to tell you how I go through it.
Yeah.
And then it's an exhausting exercise. Mm-hmm. But that kind of defeats the purpose of having the conversation.
Mm.
Because if people are scared about having the conversation and people don't really want to have the conversation because they're tired of having to deal with it,
mm-hmm.
Then it becomes a little bit difficult.
Yeah.
So I kind of wanted to ask you, where do we kind of strike the balance?
I think I had this conversation on Instagram actually, but I think it's about allowing the people of color who want to speak about racism to white people to do it and not forcing every single person of color to do it, because there are some people that don't mind doing the work, especially if, unfortunately, if you're a person of color that's grown up around white people, you kind of have to do it. So I think it's allowing those people to speak, but then also white people knowing when to listen and not when to share their own experiences.
I think that was really, 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 really a case during the whole Black Lives Matter movement in summer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if you had the same experience, but I definitely had this experience where I had people messaging me,
mm-hmm.
and asking me if there was any time in which I had done anything,
mm-hmm.
I would like to apologize and I would like to learn. And then they were asking me to teach them or ask questions, and I didn't know how to react because I didn't even think of us having an issue or anything like that. But mm-hmm. to have that sort of interaction was very, very weird.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, as someone who I like you, I have conversations about race with my friends of race, because okay. not of race, of color.
Yeah.
So when I have conversations with my friends of color, they understand. So it's not an exhausting conversation sometimes, because mm-hmm. I don't have to break down all the little intricacies.
Yeah.
I found it a very, very weird experience. Mm-hmm. Like, I had automatically become a spokesperson just because I was Black.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you 100%. Like, when it comes to having the conversation, I think it needs to be people who actually want to have the conversation.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Because not like we aren't a monolith. Not every single Black person wants to be Malcolm X mm-hmm. and every single day and sit down and have a conversation and educate people.
Yeah.
So what sort of things do you think that non-people of color can do to really start educating themselves and helping them learn for themselves how to deal with race relations and race conversations?
I think it just goes back to firstly analyzing how you feel and why you feel it, and then just doing the work of reading, and it doesn't have to be reading documentaries. That's the main way, I think, educating yourself about the history of racism. And I think it's important to know that, like, you're not going to get everything overnight. There's so many things that I don't know, that people like Akala, even he said that he doesn't know everything. So I think it's about just doing the education, really, and also trying to contribute to charities. And I think the main thing for non-Black people is to educate the non-Black people around them, because they will only listen to you. If it comes from us, they won't listen to us. So yeah.
As a white woman, I find talking about race crucial. I think it is so, so important, because no matter how much reading I do, how many podcasts I listen to, there is just simply so much that I will never understand because I won't experience it firsthand. So to me, I think in the climate that we're in, there is so much information available, and so many people to be able to talk to, be that friends, family members, co-workers. I think that the topic of race is so, so important, just in everyday conversations. It doesn't have to be a sit down, let's have a discussion, but it's about welcoming it into everyday conversation and just breaking it down every now and again to understand it better and hopefully create a more united community, I think.
So we've spoken about what non-Black people can do to educate themselves, mm-hmm. but I think also, I'm not sure if you feel the same, but I think also people of color as well
mm-hmm.
can do some self-education as well.
Yeah.
Because when we do have a look at issues like colorism, for example,
mm-hmm.
I think a lot of times when I see colorism conversations on Instagram or Twitter or wherever it may be, you see a lot of ignorant comments.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you're killing yourself.
Yeah.
And you don't even realize that you're poisoning yourself right now. So I was wondering, in your opinion, what sort of things do you think that people of color can actually do to educate themselves to realize that, you know, that it's not just a one-sided thing. Like, a conversation is two ways. You need to have one person speaking and another person listening.
I think it's the exact same, to be honest. And I think more so for like non-Black people who are people of color to listen to Black people. In as much as they experience racism, there's also a lot of anti-Black ideologies and like Asian and Arab communities and stuff like that. So I think it's about them doing the learning as well, and also listening to the experiences of underprivileged people within the Black community, so like LGBT community and women and stuff like that. So I think that's also something that people need to think about.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's a really, really good point that you brought up, the smaller groups within the minority.
Mm-hmm.
And you also brought up a point before about misogyny noir.
Yeah.
I actually learned about that not too long ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I was hoping that you could break that down a little bit. Just the whole idea of misogyny and why it's such a bad thing.
Well, misogyny means the hate of women. It's not the literal hate of women, but essentially it's the way that society hates women. And misogyny is specifically the way that society hates Black women. So yeah, it's just the different ways that the society, the different ways in which society treats Black women. Essentially, that is what misogynoir is. Is it's a specific type of way that Black women are treated in every single area in life, from like how many Black women have spoken about their experiences in hospitals to relationships to sex to everything. So yeah, that's what misogynoir is.
Okay. And as a Black woman yourself, mm-hmm. what would you say that that people could really do to actively prevent falling into that trap of actually being part of being misogynistic towards Black women?
I think listen to our experiences and take your privilege out of it. I think it's hard when you're speaking to a Black man about the experiences of Black women, because they think because they are Black that we're all treated the same, but it's not, because we're treated differently by Black men. So I think listening about our experiences and educating yourself, and also not always asking Black women to do the work for you, like do the work yourself. So yeah.
Amazing. I've got one last question for you. And it's actually a little quote that I actually saw on your Instagram actually. So it was a photo, it was black and white. I think it really emphasized the point as well. And there was a card being held up, and it was a quote saying, pro-black doesn't mean anti-white.
Mm-hmm.
I really wanted to understand, why do you think that is a difficult concept for a lot of people to grasp?
Essentially, because people think pro-black is anti-white, because, and this usually comes with white people, because like I said before, they do not see racism. Yeah, they don't. A lot of them will say they don't see race. So if someone's saying I'm pro-black, they're basically saying, oh, so you're against me. That's why they think it's anti-white, which is not the case. Because if you go on Google right now and type in beautiful woman, you'll see white women. That's all you'll see. So being pro-black is basically saying, no, I'm also beautiful too. And it's adding your picture to where the pictures are not seen, essentially. So that's what being pro-black is. It's not anti-white.
If you've made it here, then you've just finished episode 5 of Team Waffles, A Guide to 2021, featuring Habiba, a freelance writer. Make sure, if you've enjoyed this episode, to check us out on all social media platforms at Tea and Waffles Pod and join in the conversation. Finally, make sure to stay tuned for more topics, more amazing guests, and more importantly, more waffle.